be the last time she saw him alive. But as long as his body could be retrieved, her mission here would be a success, and the world would be a safer place. It might even mean the beginning of the end for the Huli Jing. She turned to Yi, his eyes bored into the surveillance image of Wicks.
Sergeant, I'll be going in after the site is secured to put eyes on Wicks. Notify Singapore police. They'll want to prepare extradition papers in case he survives. And when the raid goes down, I want you in here as my eyes and ears.
Will do, Inspector.
Marcotte exited the command truck. Chapter 28. Kenneth Durand stared down at Mr. Vegas.
Get up.
Vegas meekly rose from his kneeling position. He waved the security men away.
Get out of here!
He looked up at the catwalks above.
You! Get to your posts!
Most of the men started filing out, as did the child soldiers marching smartly. Suddenly, a familiar child's voice echoed from a steel catwalk above them.
Vegas!
Everyone looked up to see Kimberly, the precocious 6-year-old girl who emceed the fashion show. She still wore her small sequined gown with a tiara, but she looked annoyed as she pushed past exiting security men on the catwalk above. She frowned.
What have you done now?
Vegas threw up his hands.
I had business.
She marched down a metal staircase to join them.
I told you I had something important to discuss. The next thing I know, you've disappeared to do something stupid.
Daughter, we have guests.
I know that.
Kimberly somberly approached Durand and bowed.
Savadika, Kun Marcus.
Brian Frey stared back and forth between Durand, Vegas, and the little girl, clearly knocked off balance by the sudden turn of events. Vegas looked aghast.
Kimberly, you knew this was Kun Marcus?
I recognized him from the stage. What sort of fools are running reception? His face is all over the news. Your people are not doing their jobs.
Kimberly again turned to face Durand.
Our apologies, Kun Marcus. How may the Luke Krung serve the fox with nine tails?
Durand narrowed his eyes at the little girl, whose opinion seemed to be held in high regard here. Frey looked to Durand quizzically. Durand felt his tattoos almost pulsating. His anger was not ebbing.
The authorities are pursuing me. I must change form before proceeding.
Kimberly's eyes grew wide.
You will be changing form here?
Your people will assist me.
Vegas whined deeply once more.
Kun Marcus, you honor us. I was told the change agent would not be permitted outside of Naypyidaw to use it here.
Naypyidaw.
Durand committed the name to memory. He pressed.
We have a police informant among the Huli Jing. They betrayed me, and I will find them.
Vegas and Kimberly looked concerned.
I assure you there is no police informant here, Master.
That may be.
Durand leaned toward Vegas. But my right hand is close by and waiting.
If I'm betrayed here, there will be no mercy.
Vegas blanched.
Otto is here? In Pattaya City?
Kimberly's face scrunched up, and she actually began to resemble a little girl. To Durand's horror, tears began to flow down her face. He felt his tattoos start to waver. Kimberly looked up at Vegas with actual fear.
The mirror man isn't coming, Papa, is he?
Vegas moved over and hugged her close, patting her tiara.
There, there, daughter. Otto has no reason to come here. As Master Wicks said, Otto is only looking for a police informant.
Vegas looked up at Durand.
And there is no police informant here. On my life, we are not fools.
Durand also took note of the name of Wicks's right-hand man. Otto. It was obvious the man was greatly feared. There was value in that. Frey had started showing signs of intellectual life again, coming out of his paralysis at the complete reversal of his fortunes. He observed the crying girl with interest.
You call Otto the Mirror Man?
She sniffled and buried her face in Vegas's brocade jacket.
You have not yet met Otto?
Frey spoke carefully.
No, I just met Master Wicks a few days ago.
Duran noticed his tattoos were beginning to fade now at the little girl's tears. He moved Frey bodily aside and spoke to Vegas.
We don't have time for this. I need your technicians to reverse engineer the change agent. There should still be traces of it in my blood.
Vegas and Kimberly exchanged startled looks. She looked up and wiped away her tears.
Vegas asked, Reverse engineer? Kun Marcus, do you not have the change agent with you?
Not here. And because there's a traitor among the Huli Jing, communications are suspect.
He pointed.
You will keep silent about my arrival.
Of course, you have our word.
I brought a genomic sequence I want to transform into. Dr. Frey here will work with you using my blood sample to search for traces of the change agent, and we'll take it from there.
Frey nodded weakly at first, and then more assertively to the others.
Just show me to your labs.
Kimberly and Vegas looked doubtfully at each other.
We will happily do as you ask, Kun Marcus, but...
A klaxon and strobing lights suddenly went off. Frey glanced around.
What the hell is that?
Someone shouted,
Tamruat!
Vegas blanched.
A police raid? But they have been paid. They have all been paid.
He manipulated unseen virtual objects in his LFP glasses, apparently checking surveillance camera feeds.
Arintarat anti-terror teams! Why are...
He gasped, then turned in fear toward Durand. Durand was momentarily shocked, but recovered quickly enough to glare at Vegas.
If you've betrayed me...
No, no, Master! It was not me, I swear it! We only just now learned of your presence! And we will get you out safely. This will prove our loyalty. I swear to you. I have a private escape route. Follow me.
With that, Vegas grabbed Kimberly's hand and ran toward the sliding industrial door. Durand and Frey exchanged confused and worried looks. Frey pointed.
We need to go. Apparently someone somewhere recognized you.
Durand and Frey followed Vegas out the door and down a side corridor. Vegas waved frantically as the alarms continued.
Hurry! This way!
He brought them through a storeroom abutting a commercial kitchen. They could hear panicked screams of clients fleeing the ballroom. Pops of gunfire or perhaps doors being breached. Durand shouted at Vegas.
Tell your men not to shoot at the police. Tell them to surrender.
Surrender? But, Kun Marcus, the police must be delayed. We need time to escape. Evidence must be cleared from memory. Genetic material destroyed.
The quicker the police take control of this lab, the sooner they'll be focused on gathering evidence and not chasing me. The only priority is for me to escape. This facility means nothing.
But, Kun...
Durand silenced him with a glare. Vegas nodded uncertainly.
I cannot guarantee my men will surrender. The jail time alone.
Tell them the Huli Jing will look after those who obey, but only those who obey.
Vegas struggled, but finally started shouting commands in Thai into his LFP comlink. Frey whispered,
What on earth are you doing? We need to escape.
Durand hissed,
This place needs to be shut down, and I don't want police officers or civilians to die in the process.
Up ahead, Kimberly had stopped at a blank wall in a corner. She made several somatic gestures to a surveillance camera, and a hidden door opened. Vegas shouted,
This way!
Durand and Frey followed. Otto walked through double glass doors into the refined lobby of the Luk Krung Clinic. His tactical police escort stood nervously to either side, local officers in balaclavas, helmets, and black body armor bearing yellow police labels in English, their weapons at the ready. Corrupted men all, too tempted over the years by the unlimited money the Hu Li Jing could offer. Now regretting, Otto knew, their years of payoffs, they could not now, even on a day like today, refuse their true masters. Too much evidence could be used against them. The corporal on Otto's left swore under his breath as he looked ahead to see a dozen heavily armed Arintarat anti-terror teams moving in formation down the corridors of the lab, long guns out, tactical lights on, clearing rooms and shouting at unseen people to get on the ground. The corporal turned toward Otto, but soon looked away, clearly spooked by the young man's disturbing aura.
"We should not be here, sir. Our orders are to stay clear of this lab."
Otto shook his head slowly as he straightened his pale green silk tie in a nearby mirror.
"Sir, they will ask me who you are. They'll analyze surveillance video. We will be found out, all of us arrested."
He paused.
"Sir, please, listen to me. I am on your side."
Otto noticed a bronze plaque indicating a restroom. The door was wedged open. Chalk marks on the wall showed it had been cleared by earlier teams.
"Before we go, I need to use the restroom."
"Are you kidding?"
The corporal sighed in frustration and motioned for his two even more skittish companions to follow.
"Is he really using the bathroom?"
The other whispered,
"We need to leave."
Otto strolled calmly toward the restroom.
"Come with me."
They reluctantly followed. The sounds of doors being broken in and screams echoed in the corridors farther on. The restroom was nicely appointed, tasteful, muted stone and wood tones. A small water feature with water lilies occupied one corner. Otto stepped in front of a large mirror while his tactical escort stood nervously nearby, their radios squawking. Otto took a comb from a tray on the counter and began to carefully comb his slicked back hair.
"Sir, this is not the time."
"I'm the only one who needs to be concerned about the time, Corporal."
Otto removed a silver flask from his jacket pocket and placed it reverently on the stone countertop. He took a deep breath and then opened the unusually complex cap, unlocking its several different seals. He then poured out a clear liquid onto his hands and slicked the liquid into his hair, combing it in fastidiously. There were gunshots in the distance.
"Sir, please!"
"Unlike Apaxi variants, Lioxol is not a contact biotoxin, but an aerosol. Extremely powerful, and even more so as it evaporates."
Otto then rubbed some of the liquid on his neck and then again onto his hands. Confused, the corporal stepped forward, clearly having had enough.
"Sir, we must—"
He never finished the sentence. Instead, he collapsed face forward, hitting the counter hard and rolling off onto the floor. The other two officers rushed to help him, but they themselves staggered and then collapsed. One of them had a momentary seizure, then went largely still, his booted foot spasming as his last breath left him. Otto gazed at his own reflection in the mirror as he placed wireless earphones in each ear. He turned up the volume on Bach's glorious Cantata BWV 19 and conducted the soaring arias with his hands. He'd only recently learned of it, and it filled him with joy. What humans were sometimes capable of always amazed him. Otto left the restroom and moved deeper into the Luk Krung Clinic. He strode down the corridor with his hands held open and outward in surrender. A balaclava-wearing tactical officer guarding a line of zip-tied prisoners glanced up to see Otto approaching. The prisoners sat, weeping. Middle-aged Brits, Germans, Chinese, French, well-heeled and well-dressed clients from around the globe. The officer raised his weapon at Otto and shouted,
"You! Down on the ground! Now! Down on the ground!"
At least, that's what Otto guessed the man said. He couldn't hear him over the music. But Otto knew the drill. He complied immediately, hands still raised.
"Hands on the back of your head!"
Otto did so. Another tactical officer joined the first, and they rushed toward him, a thicket of zip ties ready on their utility belts. One grabbed Otto's wrist with his gloved hand, but a moment later the officer staggered, then collapsed. Otto's hand was suddenly released. Almost simultaneously, the officer in front of Otto crumpled, twitching. Otto rose to his feet again, then stared at the shocked and zip-tied tourists. They started babbling at him in their native languages. Otto could see their mouths moving, some angry, others terrified. But Otto could not hear them. All he could hear were the blissful strains of the cantata. Otto walked alongside the dozens of zip-tied lab clients, running his fingers through their hair and meeting their confused expressions. An anti-savior. He could feel their lives evaporating beneath his fingertips. He was convinced he could feel it. He walked onward, the line of dead growing behind him, leaning on one another, extending down the corridor. Otto walked on, conducting a soaring chorus. He turned a corner and almost immediately came upon a large breaching team with heavily armed tactical police with bulletproof shields, body armor, ballistic helmets, blinding lights stabbing out from their guns. They led a dozen suited and zip-tied tattooed Lukkrung gang members back toward the lobby. The moment the police spotted Otto, lights and guns focused on him. He raised his hands high. He couldn't hear their voices over the music, but behind their black balaclavas, he could see their jaws moving, shouting at him. Otto complied with commands he knew well. He knelt in the hall, placed his hands on the back of his head as the team moved over and around him, grabbing his hands roughly. They soon surrounded him, and then he felt them slipping away. First one fell, then five, then 10 more, staggering as the long guns dropped from their hands. The last one hit the wall and slid down into a crumpled heap. Only a few molecules of Lioxol in the olfactory channel. That was all it took. Death followed moments later as the central nervous system shut down. Otto calmly stood and approached a dozen handcuffed and kneeling Lukkrung members. Their faces were portraits of terror as he approached. They knew who Otto was. Some among the doomed men wept, praying to the spirits of their ancestors in Thai. As Otto moved through them, continuing down the hall, he rubbed their bald, tattooed scalps. He did not wait to see the bodies drop. There would be no witnesses, no living evidence, no outward sign of the outrages here. Only the dead. And Marcus Wicks would be among them, putting to rest once and for all the search for the leader of the Huli Jing. Otto continued down the corridor, toward the concealed rooms that he knew Vegas kept. Durand and Frey followed Kimberly and Vegas down a narrow utility corridor lined with power and HVAC conduits. Vegas glanced back, urging speed with a flurry of his hands.
"You and I will depart, Kun Marcus, while Dr. Frey and Kimberly remain behind."
Frey shouted,
"The hell I will! There is only so much room. You will see."
Kimberly shouted,
"You promised me!"
Kimberly, you are a 6-year-old child. They will not punish you. You can pretend to be a simpleton.
She punched him in the ribs ineffectually.
I think that might be easier for you.
Vegas glanced back at Durand.
The girl will be sent to a foster home. We'll have her back immediately.
Durand stared darkly.
Dr. Frey is going with me. You stay behind.
Vegas looked horrified.
But I can be of great help to you, Kun Marcus. I can do so much to assist you if I am not captured by the police.
They reached the base of a metal staircase. Durand vaulted up the steps, passing Vegas and emerging in a small warehouse with a painted concrete floor. A small helicopter sat in the middle of the room on a marked helipad, though there was no obvious exit. The chopper was made of a white chitinous material, probably a grown shell, with a bulbous tinted windshield. Outboard on each corner of the craft were dual counter-facing propellers, about a meter in diameter, 8 in all. Frey moved alongside Durand with Kimberly and Vegas. Frey nodded to himself.
I'll be damned. An E-hang.
Vegas nervously motioned to it.
Very complex. You need an experienced hand to get it working.
Kimberly pouted and folded her arms.
He's lying. It's autonomous, programmed for a pre-planned escape route.
Damn you, child.
Durand had seen vehicles like these flitting over Singapore in small numbers, a commutation option for the well-off. As he approached, the interior lit up, followed by the passenger doors opening. A synthetic voice spoke.
Please enter and fasten your safety belts.
Frey looked inside.
I think we can manage that, Tang.
Sirens could be heard through the nearby corrugated metal walls. Vegas shouted hopefully.
We need to leave, Kun Marcus.
Frey nodded.
Yes, and we will.
Durand walked around to the far side of the E-hang.
Where will it take us?
Vegas's eyes lit up.
A place only I know.
Can I use it to get back to my headquarters?
In Myanmar? Oh no, Kun Marcus. Napier Dar is much too far, and the waypoints and exchange sites are already programmed.
Exchange sites?
The escape all pre-planned. You really should take me with you.
Dr. Frey has the knowledge I need. Durand glanced up at the ceiling. It wasn't much over 10 meters. He entered the chopper anyway. Frey climbed in on the other side and began strapping himself in.
Can this thing really maneuver in here?
Frey shrugged. It got in here somehow. He noticed a leather satchel secured between the seats and unzipped it. Inside were thick wads of Thai baht.
Vegas's go-bag, apparently. He really did think of everything.
Just then, the synthetic voice returned, saying pleasantly, "Stay clear of the doors. Stay clear of the doors. Launch sequence commencing." Vegas shouted over a whining sound that kept increasing.
"Please, Master, take me with you!"
Kimberly stood nearby and rolled her eyes dramatically. Durand shouted,
"Don't worry, you'll be taken care of."
A moment later, the doors eased shut, and conditioned air filled the cabin. Frey looked around at the cultured leather seats.
This is rather nice.
The electric motors whirred to life, and an integral glim displayed AR gauges and maps into their retinas, none with any apparent inputs. They were merely passengers. Then the twin quad-mounted rotors spooled up, a roar and a wind building in the hangar. The AI voice said calmly, "Prepare for combat takeoff."
"What's a combat?"
Frey didn't get a chance to finish his sentence. The E-hang lifted off the floor and nosed downward all in one fluid motion and started hurtling toward the corrugated metal wall.
"Shit!"
The wall slid aside in 2 sections as if on explosive bolts, and the autonomous chopper roared into the sunlight and then down. Frey screamed, and Durand felt his stomach drop as they hurtled toward a street choked with emergency vehicles and flashing police lights. Then it pulled up, rotated violently, and roared down the narrow city street at an angle, just centimeters away from a tangle of utility lines. Frey pressed his arms against the cabin wall.
Jesus H. fucking Christ!
The chopper lurched upward, soared through an open atrium between the hotel towers as tourists ran screaming for cover. The chopper then streaked out over a decorative pond, then down over a rail line, emerging beneath power lines, and then up and out across a vast container yard, dodging between construction cranes.
No, 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 no.
Durand shoved back against Frey's clawing hands.
Would you stop grabbing at me?
G-forces again slammed Durand and Frey into their seatbacks as the machine kept accelerating, dodging around buildings, under power pylons, and around cranes.
I'm going to be sick.
Don't you dare, Brian.
Durand gritted his teeth against the G-forces. A glance to his left, and he noticed a lawnmower-sized police drone on their tail as the E-Hang arced in a steep turn. The police drone's camera array gleamed in the sunlight.
Police drone!
Frey sucked in a breath, still pressing with all his might against the cabin wall.
What the hell do you expect me to do about it? I'm busy trying not to shit myself!
They began curving out across the harbor front at what seemed like a meter above the water, literally dodging between pleasure boats and floating restaurants. Tourists dove into the water as the chopper roared toward them.
Oh, God!
They turned sideways, zipping between the faux funnels of an imitation steamboat-themed restaurant. They then rocketed between autonomous container ships, under rope lines, and finally in a curving trajectory that crushed Durand back into his seat, air expelled unwillingly from his lungs. Frey shouted,
I should have let Vegas go with you!
Vegas stood in the hangar, watching the open doors and the police drones hovering beyond. Humid heat began to invade the room. He could hear sirens and shouting voices on the street below. Kimberly poked him in the ribs.
Were you really going to leave me behind?
Vegas sighed.
I would never leave you behind, daughter. At least not for long. You are my treasure.
But then, Vegas felt a disturbing sensation, as though a bad spirit had come near. He turned toward Kimberly. Tears were running down her cheeks, and her mouth stuttered. She visibly trembled. Despite his fear, Vegas moved to hold her.
What is it, child? What's wrong?
She sucked for air amid terrified sobs.
The mirror man is here.
Vegas turned to see a face he did not recognize rise slowly up the staircase behind them. Each step on the metal staircase echoed. Vegas's heart began to thunder in his chest. Even though Vegas knew what Otto was, he still felt a primal dread that went beyond reason. Some things humans have evolved to fear. Vegas held Kimberly close, her sobs now uncontrollable.
We helped the master escape, Otto. He is safely on his way back to Myanmar. I gave him my own chopper.
Otto stood still 5 meters away. The humid breeze blew in past Vegas from the open hangar doors. The man's slick hair did not move. Neither did his grim expression change.
Then he is gone.
Vegas nodded.
Kun Marcus is gone. Yes, he is gone home.
Otto did not respond immediately.
He said we would be taken care of. I cannot go to jail. My daughter needs to be cared for.
You will not go to jail. None of you will.
Otto started walking toward them. Vegas noticed what looked like beads of sweat over Otto's face. though he had only been in the tropical air for a few moments.
Wait! Otto, you know that we would never betray the Hu Lijing. We are loyal servants. We will tell the police nothing.
You won't have the chance.
No, please.
Vegas found himself hoping for the police, for the Arintarat 26 to come rushing up the staircase and gun down the otherworldly Otto. But that did not happen. Kimberly trembled, gripping Vegas's arm, sobbing.
I'm afraid. I don't want to die.
Otto stood next to them.
Then you are one of the lucky ones.
He ran his fingers through her hair.
Most who I visit beg for death.
Vegas and Kimberly collapsed onto each other in the middle of the concrete floor. Their dead eyes stared at the ceiling. Lingering just a moment, Otto looked out the open hangar doors, nodded to himself, and descended the stairs again. Frey gripped his armrests and stared in terror as the Ehang chopper roared between three-story strip malls under flyways. Each time the chopper seemed a split second away from crashing headlong into a wall or colliding with light poles or wireless towers, it turned away with stomach-churning suddenness. To their relief, the Ehang finally raced out across the countryside, past temples, chedis, stupas, and long rectangular rice paddies. Only here did the chopper finally relax its crazy zigzagging flight path and instead soar in a beeline across the fields, barely a meter above the tips of the rice stalks waving in the wind. Durand looked around them through the bulbous, tinted canopy. An AR display also provided a virtual rearview mirror.
Looks like we lost the police drones.
Frey still gripped the armrests.
I don't think even they could keep up with this thing.
He nodded toward the windshield.
Any lower and we'll be harvesting this goddamned rice.
They whizzed past farmers, who shook their fists and shouted. Frey's face dropped as he turned forward again.
Oh, God, no.
A raised berm between rice fields approached. Numerous scooters traversed its length, but the Ehang roared toward it at 300 kilometers per hour.
No, no, no.
The chopper streaked through the gap between scooters, and they raced out over the fields beyond. Frey closed his eyes.
Why the hell do I even look? It's only going to upset me.
Durand gazed at the rice paddies unfolding before them. It was going to be difficult for anything except fixed-wing aircraft to catch up to them now, and those would take a while to scramble. The Ehang gained a bit of altitude and began to curve rightward. Frey groaned.
What now?
The chopper flared back, bleeding off speed with its rotor wash as it descended, then pitched forward to fly straight through the opening doors of a nondescript corrugated metal warehouse. The chopper rotated before setting itself down in a marked space alongside a second Ehang chopper, this one red with yellow stripes instead of clean white.
Thank God.
Frey unbuckled his safety harness. The doors to the second chopper opened, beckoning, and its electric motors began to spool up. Their own chopper rotors whined down only slightly as the doors opened. A synthetic female voice said,
"Second vehicle waiting. Second vehicle waiting."
Durand jumped out, shouting, "It's an exchange. Grab the go bag and get moving."
God damn it.
Frey took the bag and practically fell out of the first chopper. He ran on unsteady feet toward the second.
Looks like Vegas programmed vehicle changes into this journey.
Durand got into the waiting aircraft. Frey crawled in on the far side.
We don't even know where we're going.
The doors closed.
Anywhere's better than back there, and Vegas clearly seems to have planned for the worst.
The rotors wind up and the new chopper lifted off the moment Frey fastened his safety harness. It nosed through the doors that opened on the far side of the warehouse. Looking back, Durand could see their original chopper racing back the way they'd come, gaining altitude in an apparent effort to attract attention and lead away any pursuers. The new chopper raced low across the rice paddies, heading north and away from Pattaya City. Chapter 29. Word came down, and Diana Marcotte followed a second wave of Thai police into the now secured Luk Krung Clinic facility. She wore a tactical vest with the word Interpol stamped across the front and back in large white letters. Her group included evidence technicians, uniformed Royal Thai police officers, a couple of media camera teams, and a high-ranking Thai police official in formal attire. They entered through the parking garage where the glass doors of the clinic led into a tastefully decorated lobby. Marcotte spoke to Sergeant Michael Yi Ji-Chang through her LFP phone link.
They're finally letting us in with the evidence teams. Any word on Wicks?
Hang on. Something's up, Inspector. The commanders are shouting at each other in Thai now.
The sound of men shouting at one another was audible in the background.
There's been some sort of problem. A big one from the sound of it.
A shout went up near Marcotte. She walked forward to see a police official shouting at camera crews, who were filming dozens of human bodies splayed across the corridor, some of them handcuffed European and Chinese civilians, and others black-clad Thai tactical police. Their dead eyes stared. More shouting as the officials pushed the camera crews back.
Holy hell!
There were at least 3 dozen bodies in the main corridor, but none of them had visible injuries. There was no blood.
What are you seeing?
Sergeant, there are dead people everywhere in the corridors, civilians and police.
What the hell's going on?
I don't know, but I think the command center just discovered it.
Just discovered it? How the hell did they not notice? This place isn't secured.
Police teams moved forward with handguns raised, and as soon as they came around the corner, they moved back, alarmed.
More dead. Dead everywhere.
I need information, Sergeant.
There was more shouting in the background of Yi's phone. Close to Marcotte, a police official lifted his head from a radio and shouted,
"Poison gas! It's poison gas!"
The politicians, media, and police panicked equally, stampeding back toward the exit. Marcotte followed.
"Someone's saying there's poison gas in the lab. Is that true?"
"I just got the word. This is bad."
Marcotte moved out through the parking garage.
"Information, Sergeant, now."
"They're reviewing cicada footage. They've got people down all over, Inspector. It's looking like someone released poison gas inside the lab.
There are civilians dead. Maybe a lot of them."
She walked up the concrete ramp with dozens of other police, most of whom were pushing away media cameras in a very threatening way. Others clutched handkerchiefs to their faces in the vain hope this would somehow stop nerve gas.
"From what I saw in there, it would have to have been a nerve toxin.
I'm looking over their shoulders at surveillance video right now. There's a guy walking around with no gas mask or anything. People are just dropping dead as he passes by them. He's dressed like the game show host from hell."
"He's not spraying anything on them?"
"No. He just walks within a few meters and they drop."
"That sort of toxicity level, just a breath or two, how could he be immune? That's impossible."
"Well, I'm looking right at it."
"Where is this guy now?"
"They're reviewing footage."
A pause.
"Oh my God. Inspector, it looks like we've got mass casualties on our hands."
Marcotte felt like punching a wall.
Wicks.
Someone else was shouting in the background of Yi's phone now.
The political shit has really hit the fan here. I'm being shoved out of the command truck,
Yi shouted to someone.
We weren't the ones who planned this!
God damn it, Yi!
Yi!
Yeah. What's the status of the breaching teams? What about the civilians?
They're bringing hazmat teams in, robots, but they're pulling everyone out for now, distributing mop gear.
There are scores of civilians in that lab. Children. The Lukkrun could be using this opportunity to incinerate evidence.
And what about Wix? Has anyone seen Wix? He's the one behind all this.
An autonomous chopper took off from one of the nearby buildings a couple minutes ago. Looks like it's been modded. He's flying below radar, literally at treetop level all over the city.
She pinched the bridge of her nose in frustration.
How the hell did the recon teams miss a helicopter on the roof? That's the first thing they should have secured.
Apparently, it came out of some hidden hangar. They have no idea who was in it. Police drones are in pursuit.
God damn it. Find out if anyone has Wix, and get me the status of that chopper pursuit.
We'll do.
Marcotte moved out of the parking garage and into the open air. Reporters were swarming the police now, with additional police coming in to push the reporters back. Police sedans whooping their sirens came up to collect the officials. More police formed a blockade at the mouth of the parking garage, shouting for reporters to stay back. A police officer walked past distributing black S-10 gas masks. He pushed one into Marcotte's hands, shouting,
"Must wear. Orders."
Marcotte grabbed the mask and looked at the gathering media circus. As soon as they saw the gas masks, they all dove for them, trying to be the first to do a live remote masked up. The media. Dozens of dead civilians and police was an unmitigated disaster to the task force. Not even she would have guessed that Wix would be evil enough to release poison gas just to cover his escape. Marcotte felt a sinking feeling. Had she caused this? Were people dead because of her? She glanced up as she heard a shout behind her. Three Thai motorcycle police officers manning the roadblock at the end of the street aimed their pistols at a well-dressed man who had just emerged from a stairwell door to the parking garage. Marcotte perked up, since the man had to have come from the Lukkrun clinic. There had been tactical units guarding the stairwell, but no longer, apparently. She moved toward the scene as the motorcycle cop shouted in Thai. The man looked to be an Asian businessman, Mongolian, perhaps. He wore a tailored, pinstriped suit, his jacket splayed open as he raised his hands. He calmly obeyed orders to kneel, then put his hands on his head as the officers moved in for the arrest. Suddenly, the lead officer collapsed face down onto the pavement alongside the suspect. The other two staggered. One dropped his gun, and then they both collapsed as well. The man looked over to Marcotte as he calmly got to his feet. A wave of adrenaline spread through Marcotte. She barked into her LFP link.
Sergeant, he's here.
Who is? Wix?
She turned to the cluster of reporters and shouted,
"Gas masks on!"
Reporters, already puzzling over their masks, ran screaming. Cops who hadn't got them yet fled as well. Marcotte watched the suited man climb onto a parked electric motorcycle. He calmly pulled a civilian helmet on. She ran toward him, reaching by reflex for the small of her back and the gun that wasn't there.
Damn it.
Instead, she removed her LFP glasses in order to slip on the S-10 gas mask and immediately lost her link to Yi. She stuffed the LFP glasses into a pocket in her tactical vest and cinched the gas mask straps. By the time she reached the scene of the dead officers, the suspect was racing away down the street. Marcotte could clearly see one officer's dead eyes staring skyward. She ran for one of the three nearby police motorcycles. It, too, was an electric bike, which was good. They'd retired gasoline bikes before she did her 2 years in the LAPD. This one looked somewhat similar to her old patrol unit. It had an old HK416 assault rifle locked into a rack on the rear strut. She raised her LFP glasses to her mask and shouted muffled words to Yi.
Call General Prem. Get him to follow me. Tell him I'm in pursuit of the poison gas suspect.
What? I didn't copy that, Inspector. Please.
She stowed the LFP glasses again and thumbed the bike's safety and power. With that, Marcotte screeched forward, rapidly accelerating after the suited man. She weaved through traffic and turned on her lights and siren. Marcotte looked for the police radio link, but then realized it was in the officers' helmets, back where they had fallen. Their pistols were back there, too.
Stop screwing this up, baby.
Her foster mother's voice came to her at times like these. The woman was a tough cop, and she didn't care for excuses.
Keep your shit together.
Marcotte tried to take deep breaths to calm herself and focus her vision inside the suffocating mask. She was a skilled rider, but she'd never performed a high-speed pursuit in mop gear. Her lenses were partly clouding up in the stifling humidity. Marcotte hugged the electric bike close and accelerated past confused scooter drivers and tourists stuck in the dense traffic caused by the police blockade. They craned their necks to look after the black-skinned woman in an Interpol flak jacket and gas mask racing between cars on a Thai police motorcycle, its sirens whooping and warbling. Focusing through the cloudy lenses of the mask, Marcotte could see the man's bike a couple hundred meters ahead. He glanced back and clearly saw her. He slipped between cars, but she was gaining. Nobody was dropping dead around him as he passed by. Maybe his poison had been used up, or perhaps it was because he was traveling fast.
You can't stop him here, baby.
Marcotte nodded, and her foster mother would have been right. She had to get the suspect away from these crowded streets. If she collared him in the middle of all these people, he could unleash a toxin. A crowd would gather. She had to hang back. Did she risk taking off the mask? Asking for backup? If so, now was the time to risk exposure. Marcotte pulled the mask up and grabbed for her LFP glasses and slipped them on momentarily. Their lenses immediately started translating Thai road signs for her, but she shouted into her open link to Yi.
Sergeant! Inspector, what the hell's going on? Why are you moving away from the lab?
I'm pursuing the suspect in the gas attack.
How do you know what he looks like?
Because I just saw him kill 3 motorcycle cops in the street. He must have some sort of airborne nerve agent. He's racing through the city on a motorcycle. I'm following.
For God's sake, don't catch him!
I've got a gas mask. I have to put it back on, and soon.
Inspector, just hang back. Hold on!
She heard Yi shouting to someone. Marcotte was gaining on the man. He glanced back at her again, then ducked along gutters and sidewalks as necessary to maintain speed. But she was still gaining.
Inspector, police command says only to follow him. Right now, all their drones are pursuing the escaped chopper. But if this guy's got a nerve agent on him, they need him out of populated areas above all else.
Right.
Just hang back and follow. Stay away from him.
Call you when I can.
Marcotte hung up. She pulled down the gas mask and cinched the straps as best she could with one hand. The suspect glanced back at her again, then suddenly turned right down a soi, one of the narrow side streets common throughout the city. She approached the turn and leaned into it, heading down a lane lined with parked cars, hanging laundry, and garbage bins. The suspect was rocketing down the soi far ahead, quickly disappearing around a bend. Marcotte accelerated as people poked their heads out of windows and over balconies to see her race past, sirens blaring. Her powerful electric bike whined down the lane. She curved right, crossing a short bridge over a brownwater canal, and suddenly saw the suspect coming straight at her. Marcotte slammed on her brakes, skidding to a stop. The man skidded to a stop a few meters away and stepped off the bike, letting it drop. Marcotte did likewise, slipping off it as it slowed. They stood in the lane, now just a few meters apart. Her foster mother's voice in her mind.
You call that hanging back?
Pigeons, clustered on a power line nearby, began to drop off the wire en masse, dead before they hit the pavement, or rolled off the railing into the canal below. The nerve agent was clearly still potent. The man removed his motorcycle helmet and tossed it aside as he walked slowly toward her. His suit was impressively tailored. He had a silk handkerchief tastefully folded in the breast pocket. His confidence unnerved her. He seemed unhurried. Marcotte's rapid breathing was deafening inside the gas mask. She pointed and shouted in a muffled voice, "Down on the ground, now!" He did not comply. His face was broad, skin pale, eyes narrow. His hair slicked back. He looked like a young Central Asian bureaucrat. This was the first high-level member of the Hulijing she'd ever seen alive. But there was more to it than that. The wrongness hit her like a riptide, rolling around her and nearly knocking her off her feet. Was it the nerve agent acting on her? She pulled at the gas mask straps, yanking them tighter. The feeling didn't go away. There was something unnatural about the man standing before her. She'd never believed anything more strongly in her life.
What the hell are you?
He stared with unliving eyes.
I am the future.
He moved toward her. She backed up. Get down on the ground! You're under arrest!
Inspector Marcotte, I recognized you. You stand out here in Thailand.
She halted. He knew her name. This unnatural creature knew who she was. Civilians peered from windows and doorways. Locals approached on the sidewalk. Marcotte shouted through her gas mask, Get back! Danger! Get back! She waved like a lunatic. The people ducked back into their flats or edged away, but stayed watching. The man laughed.
You're on my list. You've saved me a trip.
He extended his hand.
I'll have that gas mask.
Karate had long been Marcotte's passion, something her foster mother had introduced to her. A means of personal self-defense in a world where, at times, no help was coming. One thing she'd learned in childhood was to never be helpless again. He moved in. She stepped aside and grabbed his wrist, delivering a series of rapid kicks to vulnerability points in his abdomen, side, and groin, grunting defiance with each hit. But his touch sent a jolt of revulsion through her body. She felt her bladder release, the wetness spreading. She ducked below another grab for her mask, then leaped up and gave a roundhouse kick to the side of his head that sent him reeling. He slammed into the side railing of the bridge, then quickly righted himself, shaking his head and wiping away blood from his rapidly swelling lip. Get on the ground! She felt urine running down her legs, her heart hammering in her ears in terror, her hands shaking.
You can take him. I know you can, baby.
He moved toward her.
You can hit me, but all I need is to lift your mask just once.
She weaved around him.
Look at you.
He pointed at her hands. She could clearly see that her own hands were now glistening with poison.
It only requires a few molecules in your olfactory channel.
Fear flowed through and around her.
You are dead, Inspector Marcotte. You can beat this son of a bitch, baby. And you are deaf to all those who come near you.
Her eyes narrowed.
You got that right, motherfucker.
She lunged toward him, then ducked under his grasp, clearing his legs out from under him, and hammered the side of his head with her elbow as he tried to get up. He rolled clear while she pursued him, kicking his ribs.
I don't care if you are Satan himself. I will kick your goddamned ass.
He rolled back to his feet, blood flowing down his nose, his right eye reddening. He took a moment to assess her. Then he glanced aside.
Do you hear that?
He moved away from her. She followed. She could hear children laughing, lots of them.
Do you hear them?
A bolt of fear ran through Marcotte. She lowered her hands. He ran now, down the lane, and she ran after him, struggling for breath in the gas mask after all the exertion. Running was suffocating her. She came around to a house to see a schoolyard 30 or 40 meters away. Dozens of Thai elementary school children in neat uniforms played in a fenced yard there. The suited man wiped blood away from his nose and pointed.
Follow me, and I will run toward them, and through crowded places. I will slay hundreds.
She sucked for air. Taking off the mask meant instant death. She could see the toxin glistening on her hands. She looked up into the unnatural man's dead eyes and took a measure of pride that one of them was swelling.
Crawl back into hell, but I will find you one day.
The man laughed, then backed away from her while she moved between him and the distant children. The thing righted his motorcycle, gathered his helmet, and with one last look at her, accelerated away. A friendly dog approached Marcotte, wagging his tail and barking beyond a chain-link fence.
No!
Marcotte fled back toward the bridge, running along the lane, waving off curious onlookers. She felt her lungs burning as she sucked for more from the mask, but nonetheless sprinted the last few meters to jump off the bridge into the brown water of the canal. Chapter 30. A jet-black Ehang autonomous chopper soared above the evening skyline of Bangkok. Other than its gold stripes, it looked identical to the previous four they'd ridden in a circuitous route all afternoon. Seated next to Durand, Frey sighed and looked upon the city.
That's a sight I didn't think I'd see again.
I've made a few enemies here.
Is there anywhere you haven't made enemies?
Durand gazed out the window. He'd never been to Bangkok, and the city looked beautiful as the sun set. From 500 meters up, the Chao Phraya River coiled through the midst of it like a metallic snake. The navigation lights of long-tailed boats, barges, and the occasional fishing boats speckled its length. Their chopper navigated between glittering 100-story office and residential towers, passing by other autonomous timeshare choppers, ferrying well-heeled passengers across town. Bangkok, too, had benefited from the Gene Revolution, and lots of business was being transacted here, as a gateway between China and the rest of South and Central Asia. Corruption was an issue. It was a place to do business if you couldn't do your business inside the bubble. And it was breathtakingly beautiful to fly over at night. Before long, the Ehang descended toward a spire of mirrored glass, a residential tower overlooking the illuminated Bhumibol suspension bridge. A private helicopter pad came into view on a broad terrace near a swimming pool. The multi-story residence appeared to take up the entire top of the building and was more opulent than anything Durand had ever seen up close. The Ehang masterfully maneuvered past potted palms and alighted in the center of the helipad. The rotors immediately began to wind down, and as they did, the doors remained locked. The synthetic voice said, "Please wait." Normal safety rules were apparently being enforced again. When the rotors had finally stopped, the chopper doors whirred open, and the voice said, "Thank you for escaping with us. Please exit the aircraft." Durand grabbed the leather go-bag. Then he and Frey stepped out, relieved to see no other chopper waiting for them. Frey spread out his arms at both the expansive nighttime view of the city and the river 100 stories below. He then turned to encompass the 3-story terraced penthouse behind them.
Would you look at this place?
Each floor was smaller than the one below, creating a series of large terraces. They currently stood on the middle one, overlooking an illuminated swimming pool and bar, while on their level were gardens and patio furniture, along with another bar. Above them looked to be bedrooms. All of it was softly lit and designed with a modern art aesthetic. Clean curves of polished cement and glass, along with a profusion of living things and trickling water. The plants had clearly been modified to grow into Thai cultural motifs, chedas and temples. As they followed steps down from the helipad, the Ehang's doors closed and its rotors wound up again. They watched as the chopper took off into the evening sky,